This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gap Fest 5 Men and a Baby edition. It's Wednesday, April 19th, 2017. On today's show, Five Came Back is the new Netflix documentary. It also had a theatrical release about the legendary Hollywood directors who used their considerable talents and prestige to help their country win World War II. It's based on the 2014 book by Mark Harris, who joins our discussion today. And then, Let a Thousand Think Pieces No Longer Bloom, the TV show Girls, is over. We discussed the finale and the whole phenomenon with The New Yorker's Gia Tolentino. And finally, United Airlines is the latest company in the age of Trump to find its tactics and its identity come under withering attack. What to make of the grisly footage showing a passenger being dragged off an overbooked flight? We're joined for that discussion by Slate's own Laura Miller. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
Julia, I'm so sorry to hear that you're under the weather.
I've been laid waste by some kind of allergy-related cough, so I'm trying to minimize my talking today. I'm going to join for our conversation with Mark Harris because I watched all of Five Came Back, and it seemed like a lot of prep to put on another potential gabber. Plus, every self-respecting Mark Harris fangirl wouldn't pass up the chance to talk to him. And then I'll rejoin for endorsements and plus.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much for being a trooper, Julia. And of course, we're joined by Dana Stevens, Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Stephen.
All right. Well done. Mark Harris is the author of Five Came Back, an extraordinary group portrait of the legendary Hollywood directors who put their good names, their careers, and frankly, their lives on the line to help their country win World War II. Those directors were Frank Capra, John Ford, William Wyler, John Huston, and George Stevens. And their principal contribution to the war effort was to make newsreels, but also documentaries detailing both why we were fighting the war and how we were fighting the war. Harris's book is now a Netflix documentary. It's also been in theatrical release itself. He will join our discussion in a moment. But first, let's listen to a clip.
And just to set this up, the first voice you'll hear is the director, contemporary director Paul Greengrass, talking about John Ford showing a film that he shot, I believe, at the Battle of Midway. And he's showing it to the Roosevelt White House. And as you'll hear, he decides to insert an unexpected shot, which moves the president deeply.
He found a shot. We'll never know whether it was a shot that he shot there or it was a shot that he found somewhere else. But a shot of President Roosevelt's son.
Then he set up a running of the film at the White House with President Roosevelt. And just before the White House running, he said, now put this in. I was told at that running, Roosevelt talked the way people do, and that Roosevelt would say, oh, yes, that's a B-17, and that's, and he kept talking, you know, and he had a lot to say about the film. Then when Jimmy Roosevelt's picture came up, everything was silence, dead silent. Nobody spoke from the time that shot was on the screen until the end. And then Roosevelt turned to Admiral Leahy, who was his senior aide, and said, I want every American to see this film as soon as possible.
All right. Well, we are thrilled to be joined by Mark Harris. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is such a pleasure to have you. World War II appears to us now as both kind of immense and inevitable, but of course in the 1930s, when your story properly begins, it was anything but that, especially to Americans. What, describe a little bit what the attitude of both this country and Hollywood was towards the impending war, and then what Hollywood did to help change that.
Well, you know, the attitude toward the impending war changed depending on how closely the war was impending. But one thing that really struck me was that, you know, the country was divided, you know, across the country and in Congress. There were absolutely isolationists, people who said, you know, this is Europe's problem. Let Europe solve it. It's nothing for the United States to be meddling in. And that was bound up with a lot of anti-Semitism, you know, that a feeling that Jews in America were the ones who were really trying to impel the United States toward intervention because they had mixed loyalties. They had one foot in America, but they had one foot in the old country. And that, in turn, was tied up with suspicion of Hollywood, which was, we have to remember, still a very new industry. You know, sound movies were only a decade old when war broke out in Europe. And it was seen as an industry run by Jews, by immigrants, by first and second generation Americans, by subversives, by communists. You know, there was a lot of contempt for and suspicion of Hollywood from Washington and even from the rest of the country. And that's one thing, one of the many things that the beginning of the Second World War really turned on its head.
Mm-hmm. And these five directors, just to quickly name them again, Capra, Ford, William Wyler, John Huston, and George Stevens. I mean, it's not as though they had played a small role in creating, by the late 1930s, something of the mythic self-image of America for Americans. What was it about, if you could briefly say about each one of them, that they brought to the war effort?
Well, you know, one interesting thing about these guys in the war is they were all except for Huston, were old enough to have gotten an exemption from war duty based on their age. They were all from their mid-30s to their mid-40s, and Huston could have gotten an exemption because he had some health issues. So they came to the war voluntarily and at the urging of Washington, which wanted to pull them in because of their incredible skill in telling American stories and in, frankly, selling American stories. I mean, Capra and Ford had, between them, won something like six of the last eight Oscars for directing. And the others were, you know, established to various degrees as well. You know, what they brought to the war was really different for each guy. I mean, Ford was the only one to join the Navy. For him, he had been old enough to serve in the First World War and had elected not to. So this was really a test of his own definition of courage for him. And you know, he brought, I think, what turned out to be an incredibly moving and emotional respect for loss, for sacrifice, for giving up personal glory for a greater good. You see that in his war movies and in his post-war movies. Capra stayed in Washington. He was kind of the hub who supervised the whole worldwide army war effort, and he really saw the war as an absolute black and white good versus evil. He called it a fight for a free world versus a slave world. And so the rhetoric of what World War II was all about, the rhetoric that Americans heard, but also that soldiers heard, was really largely created by Capra. Huston made three standalone war documentaries, the last of which, Let There Be Light, which was about emotionally scarred returning veterans, was suppressed for 35 years. He was the least experienced of the five filmmakers. He'd only made about 2.5 movies before he had to drop everything and go to war. So for him, the war, among many other things, was filmmaker training school in a way. It was where he began to hone his directorial style. William Wyler was the only Jew of the five directors in the war. It was very, very personal for him. He had grown up in a town that was on the France-Germany border and still had relatives and friends there. He was known as a very meticulous, precise director in Hollywood, and he brought that same kind of commitment to his war work. He didn't use recreations as many other directors did. He didn't use miniatures. He had to get everything right. And Stevens, who was the most lighthearted of the five directors, he had come up doing Laurel and Hardy shorts and Astaire and Rogers movies, ended up most in the thick of it. He was everywhere from D-Day to the liberation of Paris to the Battle of the Bulge to Dachau, and really ultimately ended the war as the great documenter of war crimes and war atrocities, which was an experience that changed him, both personally and professionally forever.
Can I just zoom out a little bit and say, I don't think I understood the degree to which World War II was filmed. So much is made of the idea that the way the television news portrayed Vietnam made it the first war that was really viscerally understood through images by the American public. And I just was ignorant of so much of this history. And the Netflix documentary is such a great way to begin to understand both how World War II was perceived by Americans at home and then the personal stories of these directors and the stuff they had to learn, about filmmaking, but also bravery and management and human nature and depravity. Like the emotional journeys that they all go on throughout the course of the documentary are really striking. But I guess one question I had for you was in moving from writing this as a book to making it as a documentary, what did you learn the second time around, or was it sort of planned as a doubleheader all the way through?
No, it was definitely not planned as a doubleheader. I didn't really have the idea that it could be a documentary until pretty close to when the book was published in early 2014. And one thing that struck me was how many people who would read galleys of the book would say to me, oh, what a shame these movies don't exist anymore. And the fifth or sixth time that I found myself explaining that, in fact, they did, I thought, oh, there's a real opportunity here to retell this story in a way that, as much as I can spend a great deal of time and care describing the Battle of Midway or the Memphis Belle or Let There Be Light, showing, 30 seconds of any of those movies has a kind of emotional impact and immediacy that just felt to me like the stuff of a documentary. And also just cumulatively, the idea of saying, as you pointed out, that this war was filmed so much more than people realize. And it was a big question for us going in, which was like, how many hours can this story sustain? Not in terms of how interesting is it, but like, how much footage do we have? Like, how much World War II stuff are we going to be able to find to be able to tell this story visually? And I was really pleased with the fact that we found enough to do 3 hours and 7 minutes.
Can I ask a question to you, Mark, as a critic, how this work and thinking and research affected the way you view these directors and their work? I feel like I learned so much about directors whose movies I love and some whose movies I know less well. In particular, understanding where the wartime effort fit into Capra's career and how it shaped the work he did afterwards, I thought was fascinating. I also had no idea how handsome John Huston was. Geez. But
yeah, the womanizing worked for a reason.
Oh my goodness. But it feels like for all of these directors, their work was profoundly changed by what they experienced in war. And I wonder how your research makes you look differently at their work as a critic.
I've always, I think, rejected a kind of purely auteurist view of movies as these things that directors hatch and you're never supposed to be interested in process or, personal issues. You're only supposed to imagine the result as something that is a thing in itself and not shaped by a zillion factors. And so for me, understanding them, understanding these five directors more as human beings, which was actually a much slower thing to come while I was researching than understanding what they did. I mean, the last thing that clicked into place for me when I was researching was getting who they were as people. It's only enriched the way I see their work. I mean, you know, certainly to know how much of his heart and of his life and of his own experience, William Wyler poured into The Best Years of Our Lives has made a big difference for me. But also directors, you know, I don't think I was particularly in sympathy with a movie like John Ford's They Were Expendable, or even necessarily with It's a Wonderful Life before I did all of this research. But looking at It's a Wonderful Life, for instance, like it's not as if the only way to watch It's a Wonderful Life is knowing that Frank Capra had just come back to Hollywood and was feeling kind of emotionally injured and neglected and forgotten and would indulge himself in sort of thinking, what if I had never been here at all? But it's an interesting way to watch It's a Wonderful Life. And you know, to understand how steeped that movie is in a kind of desperate longing on his part for things to go back to being the way they were before the war, as if the war had never happened. I mean, I've always felt that the more you know about the making of a movie, not necessarily the more you can forgive its flaws, but the richer a viewing experience it is. So that's absolutely true with all of the work of these five directors. For me, it was true, you know, on my first book, all of the work of the directors of the 1967 movies is just infinitely interesting to me now because I understand who those guys were.
Mark, before you go, I feel like I have to ask. You are one of my favorite presences on Twitter by far. You're brilliant at it. Just a master of aphorism and concision, but also withering contempt for our current president. I mean, the contrast, I just have to ask, right? It's like a kind of perverse kismet that this documentary comes out post, you know, the unexpected victory of Trump. All of its values, which are, you know, just, you know, generosity, decency, self-sacrifice, a sense of one's a non-isolation, a sense of one's place in the world, a duty, all of them, you know, poised themselves so obviously against our current political fate. Could you just speak briefly to that before we wrap?
It's a super strange thing that none of us anticipated. I mean, the last stages of the election and the election itself were happening while our editor, Will Zendarek, and our director, Lauren Bruzzero, were pretty deep into work. And we did take a moment about 2 or 3 weeks after the election just to say, you know, we're dealing with issues of things like fake news and state-run propaganda and things that have a resonance that we did not imagine they would have. Are we doing this right? Are we telling the story that we should be telling? And we all made a collective decision that we didn't want to change anything, that we would let the story speak for itself and let people who were watching Five Came Back find resonance where they would. But yeah, it shocked all of us. I mean, I got to see the first episode at Alice Tully Hall, and it was the first time I had seen any of this with an audience. And there's a moment in the first hour where we have footage of Charles Lindbergh making one of his most famous or infamous isolationist speeches where he just says over and over again, America first, America first. And there was actually this kind of quiet gasp in the room. And I can tell you like that, I mean, that episode is recounted in the book. It was always part of the script. It wasn't something we ever thought would be a kind of shock moment, and yet there it is. So I think all movies in some ways are slaves to the moment they're born into, and this one definitely got born into a moment we weren't anticipating.
All right, well, Five Came Back is now streaming on Netflix. People should absolutely seek it out. It's marvelous, as was the book it's based on. Mark, it's not sucking up if it's sincere. Pictures of a Revolution is one of the best books I've ever read on American film. It is such a pleasure to have you come on the show. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Before we go any further in the show, Dana, we have some business.
Yes, we do. The first thing I want to mention is that the Culture Gabfest's first ever live show in Washington, D.C. is happening tonight on Wednesday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hamilton in Washington, D.C. And we will have two amazing guests that we're very lucky to have, Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamel Bowie, and John Dickerson, who I don't even know how to identify. John Dickerson, the wondrous host of Face the Nation, host of the Slate Political Gabfest, and all around wonderful man. The general admission tickets are already sold out, but there are still standing room tickets and VIP tickets, which allow you to come to a pre-show meet and greet and complimentary cocktail with the three of us. So that is, again, tonight, if you happen to be listening to us on Wednesday, April 19th. Also, we're planning two shows in Australia, as Julia announced last week. The first one will be part of the Sydney Writers Festival on Saturday, May 27th at 6 p.m. at the Sydney Town Hall. And the second one, a few days later, is going to be in Melbourne on May 31st at 7:30 p.m. at the Wheeler Center. And our special guest there, Steve, get ready to squeal, is the Melbourne musician Courtney Barnett.
I don't squeal. Except maybe for Courtney Barnett.
When you see her live, you'll squeal.
I will.
Also, here's a reminder that Slate has two other live shows, Represent with Aisha Harris and Trump Cast, at the SVA Theater as part of the Tribeca Film Festival. So the Represent show will be on April 24th at 6:45 p.m. and the Trump Cast will be April 30th at 8:15 p.m. If you're interested in any of these shows, you can go to slate.com/live to get tickets and more information. And remember that Slate Plus members will get 25% off your tickets. Again, that's slate.com/live for tickets and information. Okay, next announcement is that our Slate Plus today is going to be some bonus content from our conversation with Mark Harris, the film historian and author of the book and now Netflix documentary series Five Came Back. We had such an interesting conversation with him that we went way over, but rather than cut out the good stuff, we thought we would give you the good stuff in Plus. And speaking of Slate Plus, it just so happens that right now is the best and easiest time ever to try Slate Plus because we're doing a promotion. You can get Slate Plus for free for 90 days by downloading the new iOS app at slate.com/app. And you'll get all the benefits of Slate Plus for 3 months. Decide if you want to become a member after that. And again, that's at slate.com/app. Okay, on with the show, Stephen.
The TV show Girls has been almost like a drug to the community of paid tastemakers and culture beat writers. I think for every viewer it went over, there were something like 1,000 words written about it. In case you happen to miss those, the show is about four Brooklynite young female friends and their struggles with and against one another and their own entitlement and narcissism. At the heart of it was the star and creator Lena Dunham as Hannah Horvath. In this clip, we hear her waking up in her new upstate home next to, surprisingly, Marnie.
What the fuck? Marnie, what the fuck? When did you get here?
Like 1 a.m. You were just asleep for like 13 hours.
How did you get in?
You think your country windows are secure downstairs? Think again.
What are you doing here?
I would like to help you raise your baby.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You're about to go through an incredibly intense, emotional, tough, but miraculous transition. And I would like to be here to help and support you.
Well, this is just like Adam's pitch, and that didn't work out so great. So.
No. But see, it's not, because I can admit that I don't have like a lot of other things going on. I'm currently living in my mom's home gym, and my band broke up. But the thing is, I still have a lot to give, a lot. So why not give it to you and this little angel?
I don't know, Marnie. This is just...
You think you have a lot of friends, right?
Yeah.
Who's here?
Depends on the day.
Elijah's not here. Jessa sure as hell isn't here. Adam isn't here. Shoshana literally despises all of us. Who's here? I'm here.
All right. Well, for this segment, we're joined by The New Yorker contributor Gia Tolentino. Gia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to quote from your really, really, really good piece about the wrap-up of Girls, if that's all right. You write, within a couple of months, you binged the show, it should say, somewhat belatedly. And as you say, within a couple of months, I'd caught up on the series. The binge was lovely and absorbing, and I felt glad that I'd waited. Girls was a different, better, funnier show than its obsessive and often airless coverage had made it out to be. Why don't we start there? I mean, even my introduction had a little bit of, like, you know, irony, meta-ness, and snark to it. I mean, it seems almost impossible not to treat the show as a referendum on something. You make a brilliant point, really, which is that's really evidence of how well written, directed, and acted it was, that people mistook it for something literal rather than artful. So I'm curious to hear you talk about what binging the show meant to you and where its surprise lay.
Well, yeah, from the beginning, I mean, I'm squarely within the girls' demographic. I think I'm Lena Dunham's age. It was as if people were writing about things that were happening to their friends in Brooklyn and covering it as if it were a TV show rather than, you know, writing about a TV show and covering it like it was happening to their friends. Like, there was something switched about the coverage. And so I never watched it, even though I worked at women's websites that were writing about it all the time. And everyone kept saying, you know, like, you should watch Girls. It's about you. Like, it's about us. And I was like, I don't think so. I don't think this show seems like that to me. But then as the final season was approaching and the wave of think pieces seems to have died down somewhere around season 4 or something. And so I decided to just watch it. I thought that the show, it tries to have it three ways at once to me. This is my impression, that it tried to satirize the world, also aesthetically glorify it, and also represent it with an extreme realism. And all three of those things flooded around each other all the time. And I think it made people it made it hard for people to understand which angle to write about when and what would actually make for interesting criticism.
Talk a little bit about how the show ended up. I mean, one brief comment I would have is that in an obvious sense, Lena Dunham is a miniaturist in the way that Jane Austen is. And if you are pro Lena Dunham, you will feel about her the way you feel about Austen, which is that scale has nothing to do with the magnitude of her genius in a way. And my impression as the show ended up was that it had been epic rather than small. I mean, even though it was so particularly and minutely observed, in some sense, it was really about a period and not a small period and quite a formative period in a group of people's lives. And so in an odd way, I was left with a feeling of largeness at the end of it.
I thought that the final episode seemed like everyone's writing that it, you know, was like a coda, but it seemed to me like it occurred in a sort of heaven. Like it was a post, like the Harry Potter coda where he goes to heaven briefly. Like there was something about the end. I mean, I also had the feeling of expansiveness.
Dana, you love the show. Tell me why.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that regular listeners will know that our last episode ended, literally the very end, was Julia endorsing Girls, which she didn't want to come and talk about because of her HBO connections, but she was loving the end of the show, and me saying, I feel the same way, I love Girls, and I'm not interested in analyzing it at all, after which, this is like a classic bad sitcom cut, right? Cut to me analyzing Girls the next week. Yes, I do love it, and I feel like the word airless that Gia used in her write-up is the perfect descriptor of this bubble of coverage, much of it negative and judgmental, some of it, you know, maybe overly idealizing, but always somehow outside of the show itself. And I think that point is a really important one, that this furor that's come up about, you know, Lena Dunham's public persona and all these things that have nothing to do with the show itself ignore the simple fact of the writing and directing of the show and how excellent it is and how particular it is. And also, I think now you can say at the end of 6 seasons how influential the show has been, you know, such that we are now used to seeing sort of, you know, naked, un-television-like bodies on television. I mean, that in itself was a huge breakthrough of the show. Or young women like the Broad City Women being, you know, crazy and messed up in public on television. So I think it opened all of those doors. But it opened them, again, because of its actual intrinsic qualities as a show and not just because of the splash it made or the coverage it got or something like that. It also struck me reading some of this coverage that I've been avoiding basically for all these years, that I just want to watch my Sunday night show and be left alone, that Lena Dunham polarizes in somewhat the way that Hillary Clinton does. I mean, of course, she also got in trouble for, you know, some of her videos for Hillary Clinton and the part she played in the campaign, which people were saying would turn off more millennials than it would win over. But I think Hillary Clinton and Lena Dunham both have that similar quality of,
you know, being these negativity magnets no matter what they do. And so there's a part of me that thinks that even though she has made some maybe public missteps as a public figure in general, I really admire the way she's handled her fame, which came upon her as a very young person. And I just admire her as an artist and want to see what she does next. It also struck me thinking about the generationality and supposed millennial exemplarity of the show or something that I'm not a millennial at all. I'm basically old enough to be Hannah Horvath's mother if I had had a child too young, as she arguably does in the show. But in spite of that fact, in spite of the fact that I'm her senior, I felt influenced and inspired by Lena Dunham, just by her creativity and her not giving a fuck what people thought and her, you know, forging forward with a creative project. And so she's had that kind of influence, I think, in other directions besides those who are supposed to be living the exact life of the people on the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, the coverage of Lena Dunham, there's nothing that, you know, attracts and enrages the public as much as a young white woman who's wealthy and also makes money off of self-disclosure in some way. And Lena Dunham made it into an art form with Girls and with, but there's something about the position, that as the rough position that people love to, people are obsessed with, and people couldn't let it go. And so I always thought so much of the criticism of the show was purely a criticism of how people saw her, which was one of the reasons I just never watched the show, because I thought that I didn't understand that the show was a completely different world.
Yeah, I have a feeling actually that if I were of that generation and I was hearing the constant buzz about the show that you must have been hearing in its early seasons, I would have felt the same way. Like, leave me alone. I'm not watching Girls. I'll decide what my generation means or is about. You know, stop bludgeoning me with Girls.
Right.
But the fact is that Girls itself does not bludgeon the viewer.
Right, at all. And I mean, and I also thought that, you know, people, the racial criticism of the show, I think that in the last season, you know, I think it's still true of Girls that characters of color tend to be kind of accessories and devices. And but that's how kind of all the characters are to each other. And it just gets particularly thorny when it's especially pronounced that way for characters of color. But I also think that the criticism of that is the criticism of the real world. It's a criticism of the real world that is mapped onto the show retroactively, and criticism that in a way that I think is confusing.
Right. So why don't we talk about how the show wrapped up, especially the last, you know, several episodes that dealt with Hannah's pregnancy and eventually her job. Dana, what did you make of it?
Well, I mean, there were lots of mocking, and some of them were coverage that we read for this that I would otherwise never have read. But there were plenty of mocking pieces about the job that Lena Dunham's character ends up getting, which is a teaching job at an upstate liberal arts college that seems to be this dreamy, cushy professorship in which it's never mentioned that she has no higher degree. She's never succeeded at any of her jobs on the show. She seems to be this struggling internet writer in the world of the show. She published one Modern Love column earlier this season. She has these on and off writing jobs, but you really don't get a sense of her as a successful writer. And yet she's suddenly considered this sort of hot shit writer who has to get a job at Bard or some other place like that. So many academics were mocking that, and I think that makes a lot of sense. That's probably no more ridiculous than the usual characterization of academia on television, but that was, in a way that Girls often is, a economically blindfolded decision, I think, to have her get that job so easily. And it was really to get the job problem out of the way so that the many personal problems on the show could be sorted out. The pregnancy timeline is a whole other question. I think, like Slate's TV critic Willa Paskin, who wrote on this, when I first discovered that Hannah was pregnant and going to have the baby, it kind of enraged me as a plot development. And this is, you know, this is really not a critique of the show as an exemplar of its generation, but just what you want to have happen for a character. It was, to me, it seemed like a very poor choice on her part. And also, there was a little bit of cowardice in the show having her not ever even consider an abortion for a second, and that anybody who even mentioned it is sort of placed as a character who's being hurtful to her or saying something unfeeling, you know, when in fact, if there's any character on television that would at least have considered that or talked openly about the thought of considering it, it would be Hannah Horvath, right?
So, yeah, I thought similarly about the last season, about both of those things. But I thought the season was slipping very overtly into fairy tale. Like, Girls is great when it has that weird, degraded, completely surreal fairy tale aspect to it. And I thought the entire job thing, the house upstate, the pregnancy, it bore no relationship to reality.
Of a piece with the Patrick Wilson episode,
yeah.
Right? From a few seasons ago.
And that's what I liked the best about that. Those are the episodes that I always liked the best about the show. And to me, none of the show had ever really rung that true to me. It didn't ring very personally accurate to me in any way. So when this happened, I was just like, great, this seems like a good way to end the show in an open-ended manner. Yeah, completely unrealistic, though.
But I will also say, just to wrap up on the pregnancy timeline, that I ended up forgiving the show for it because I thought it handled it so well. And I really appreciated, too, that it didn't hit, the season did not hit the expected cliched beats for main character gets pregnant episode. Mm-hmm. I was waiting for, okay, when is her first gynecology appointment? Where she's sitting in a room with a bunch of other pregnant women and feeling insecure, right? We've seen that a million times. It didn't happen. Where's the birth scene where we see Hannah giving birth, which could, I imagine, be hilariously written. But it's also something we've seen a million times. And we don't see that. We just cut straight to the baby having been born. So I appreciated those ellipses. I thought it was a really economical way to tell the story.
And the show finally made use of that misinterpretive tendency that people have always had, which is, you know, this is not like real life. And the show is like, yeah, mm-hmm. I know.
Right. They did make an interesting choice. I know we have to wrap up, but what do you make of the last shot of the episode? I want to hear from both of you.
I loved it. I cried. I mean, I knew I was going to cry at the last episode because I'll just miss this show. But I've always thought in particular that the final credits are beautifully done. I remember the last scene of season one. I don't know if you remember it, Gia, but you've seen it pretty recently probably, where her purse gets stolen on the train and she ends up at Coney Island with no money. Remember? And she's eating a piece of cake that she's taken home from a party. And it was a beautiful ending. And I think Girls is really good at that. The moment right before you cut to the credits, and then there's always a great musical moment under the credits. So I won't spoil what that musical moment is, but it's really a beautiful choice in this last episode. Yeah, I thought the last 5 seconds were a total win.
Yeah, I also thought that, as I think someone pointed out, I mean, she's gotten really good as an actor throughout this show. And I thought that her face and the close-up was incredible.
Mm-hmm. That's great. One very quick comment. In catching up with the show, I was grateful to do so. It pissed me off, but it's just, I mean, the Matthew Reese episode alone is worth a freaking Nobel Prize. It was just absolutely brilliant. The thing that really struck me and made me nostalgic for it, even though I'm an old fuck and I'm girly but not a girl, is that it's about that exact period in your life where you're building, you're both going to build on that period and you have to obliterate it. And I thought it really told that truthfully, whatever all the other supposedly annoying specifics were. It's a brilliant show. Okay. Gia Tolentino, thank you so much for coming on and discussing Girls, and people should check out your article at newyorker.com.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
A passenger on a United Airlines flight was dragged from his seat by security officers and off the plane as he screamed, and importantly, as his fellow passengers filmed the episode on their smartphones, as is now inevitable these days. The passenger has been since identified as a 69-year-old doctor. At the time, the reason he gave for not wanting to exit the plane was he needed to see patients in the morning. It's since come out that he was dragged off the plane by Chicago aviation security officers. United has offered a series of escalatingly desperate apologies, and the bloodied passenger now has a lawyer. We're joined for this segment by Laura Miller, the wonderful book critic for Slate. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. I'm curious what you make of this incident. There are many dimensions to it. There's the fact that it happened in Trump's America. There's the fact that the passenger dragged off the plane was of Asian descent. The fact that smartphones are always ubiquitous and the virality of the video is, in some sense, what makes the incident, quote unquote, real. There's the aura of desperation on the part of the corporation who manages to nonetheless mishandle its initial PR communications after the event. What should we be focusing in on here? What strikes you as most relevant?
Well, it's interesting because it's not about any kind of civic right. It's about a kind of consumer right. And there's a way that it seems like in modern America, we take that far more seriously than some of our rights as citizens, that it's just the outrage about it, which I think is partly the result of everybody feeling completely abused by airlines all the time, is also just the response that I saw was very much about how if you paid for something, you deserved obviously, you deserve not to be dragged kicking and screaming your ticketed seat.
I mean, yeah. I would actually contest that a little bit and say I think it's a place where, you know, civic rights as a, you know, just civil rights and consumer rights overlap, and that I don't know about others, but I certainly experienced it almost primarily as a traumatic symptom of Trump's America, not sort of what his business relationship had been with United or what they owed to him, but that every American deserves the right to just not be assaulted and dragged around. I'm really glad we're talking about this, by the way, even though it's a bit late. It's more than a week since it happened. But I really think this is one of the most shocking non-political stories, kind of, you know, I guess business stories or whatever you'd call it, to have come along since the election. It's just this, if this is a symptom of what living in America is going to be like, that we're having debates about whether it's okay for passengers to be dragged off planes with mm-hmm. the two teeth knocked out, a concussion mm-hmm. and a broken nose, mm-hmm. which is what this guy went and spent the night in the hospital for, then, you know, we're not going anywhere good.
Yeah, but do you really think it has anything to do with Trump?
Well, I mean, obviously that's an interpretive move, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not some sort of direct order coming down, but it seemed to me like a symptom of the decay of public space. I mean, is that too absurd?
Not actually a public space, though. I mean, I'm not going to defend the way the airline behaved, but he was on private property.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up one second.
And that's one of the things that's kind of interesting about it, is that we do think of airplanes as being kind of a public space. There's mm-hmm. so many other people on there.
Right.
But if he were asked to leave a nightclub and mm-hmm. then refused and then was kind of dragged by a bouncer, would that
right.
be as...
Well,
but if he were randomly selected, he was not abusive yeah. or drunk yeah. in the nightclub, he was not harming anyone, and a bouncer just came and punched him and dragged him out, then at that moment, I feel like he becomes a citizen. And it's a public space in the sense that that a restaurant is a public space. I mean, Slate is owned, it's a private company, but somebody can't just come in right here now and drag you out of the room.
No, but they can ask you to leave. I mean, I don't know that they were not, you know, it's interesting because what are the rights of a person to be on an airplane? What are the legal rights as opposed to what we all feel sort of on a gut level are just their, you know, the human decency rights? Like if you buy a ticket, but then the airplane can't leave for some reason and you refuse to get off. I mean, there might be any number of reasons why somebody would be kicked out of a place where they had paid to get in.
Okay.
And it might just be that the place is closing. I mean,
right.
you know, it
but,
just.
But we don't need to be overly abstract or hypothetical
yeah.
about it, because there was a specific set of events here, which is that they were asking him to leave because they had employees of the airline that, quote unquote, needed to fly somewhere. They had a choice they could make about their priorities as a business, and I think it pretty much universally acknowledged they made the incredibly stupid one. But let's back up a little bit and say, okay, on Earth 2, Hillary Clinton has properly won the election and this incident happens. I think it could be thought of as it could be equally possible that it would happen, right? That there's no causality there, that the boorishness and implicit and sometimes explicit threat of violence of Trump's personal style maybe didn't cause the incident in any any regard to happen. That said, we live on Earth One, and Trump did win, and he does have that style. Therefore, when something like this happens, it is in its own way a kind of referendum on Trump, whether or not it was caused by, you know, an increase in American brutality subsequent to the election, right? That how are we going to react? Are we civilized? I mean, sort of existential questions about identity questions about who we are and what we are as a civilization are way more acute now that we have a dipshit, who has no sense of what civilization or civil life is as president. And so I do think Dana's right in that sense, that this is a more acute or more important. I don't know that we would even be talking about this on this show if Trump weren't president in some sense. Like, we have to assert our identity as civilized people more persuasively and more omnipresently than we did before, because we live on Earth One, not on Earth Two. The second thing I would say is that, you know, airlines are quote-unquote private businesses that in fact receive enormous subsidies and dispensations from the government, from the people, essentially the taxpayer, left and right in order to operate. They continually go bankrupt. American Airlines, especially, not American Airlines, the airline, but airlines that are you know, businesses in the United States are notoriously poorly run and poorly managed. I don't know the specific details of this. I can guess that over the last 20 to 30 years, they've been redesigned to funnel as much money up to their C-suite as possible. You know, yes, in some sense, I guess in some strictly legal sense, you're in a private space. I think the kind of vaguely autocratic structure of that private space is important to getting the plane in the air safely and landed safely. You know, pilots kind of in control of that space, and to a degree, the airline and the stewards and the stewardesses as well. That said, the man had bought a ticket that he thought conferred to him the right to be conveyed by that particular airplane from point A to point B, and he was then denied that. Overbooking is a part of their business, but there have to be thought out methods for dealing with that contingency, and you know, some kind of a, you know, I mean, clearly the normal one is offering more and more and more money, but they hit that ceiling at an incredibly low level, as I understand it, and then resorted to brutality. I mean, Laura, your take on this is very interesting to me, but I kind of think I disagree with you.
Well, all I'm saying is that I think part of the level of the outrage of it is it feels like it's continuous with the generally insufferable way that airlines treat even the people who they don't try to throw off of the plane. I mean, there's a sense of embattlement as soon as you take your seat, that you're sort of in for this duration of this experience. You can't get up, you can't do this, but also it's very cramped. You're jammed in there. There are fewer and fewer amenities, and it's like a cattle car. And that, I think that one of the reasons why it speaks to everybody in a way that actually the arrest of people who are engaged in peaceful protest or some other sort of civic activity tends to divide the population is that everybody feels abused by airlines.
Yeah, I've had a joke for a long time that coach is the class where you can't be guaranteed you won't be kicked. But to have that be literalized and just realize that brute force is behind, you know, the airlines' threats or desires or wishes against the customer, to me it was just a really chilling pulling back of the curtain. And it made me feel very, very different about airports and airplanes and flying, which, you know, in spite of all of their travails in general, I kind of enjoy. I enjoy travel enough that I sort of enjoy the airplane and the airport part too. But now they do seem to me like prisons, like essentially places where there's always somebody with a gun waiting to come and, you know, hassle you. Well, before we wrap the segment, we should talk about United's corporate response, which has been bizarre and disappointing and very piecemeal. How did that strike you guys?
Well, in the sort of theater of apology, it was definitely a colossal flop. But I think part of the thing is that there was an internal communication that got leaked externally. So there was the internal communication where United was telling its staff, we know that you're trying to do the best you can and we stand by you. And of course, because the guy was being forced off of the plane for, not for another passenger, but for an United employees, it just seemed, you know, just to really rub salt in the wounds of that they just don't really care about their customers.
Right.
And then they've just been scrambling to sort of fix it ever since. And then the apologies become more and more abject, but they can't really make up for the fact of not having gotten it right in the first place.
Well, the first public apology was really just, yeah, it could have been written by Sean Spicer. I mean, yeah, that was another moment of real Trumpianism in, yeah, this, in the unfolding of this event where Oscar Munoz, is that his name, the CEO,
yeah, mm-hmm,
issued some brief statement that said something about regretting the reaccommodation. And this verb, reaccommodate, just very rightly became a subject, yeah, of widespread mockery. Yeah.
But you know that within that little corporate world, they have a million words like that they use all the time that are complete bloviation and meaningless and are just part of the culture of being inside that corporation. What it feels like is that everybody who works at United just has very little contact with the real world, as if like all they know is other people at United. They have no idea the way the public views airlines or flight travel. I just also don't understand how they ended up picking this guy. He was a 69-year-old doctor who said that he had patients to see in the morning. Part of it is that it's just sort of shrouded in this secrecy about how they decided who was going to get kicked off.
Right. And we don't have video of what happened beforehand. Right. Yeah. So it's a little bit of a he said, she said thing where, you know, he's being framed as that he was belligerent by the airlines and that he refused to get off and, you know, that he was sort of resisting arrest, to use sort of cop speak.
But let's face it, everyone is belligerent on an airplane.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? I'm so not on United's side here that I'm actually surprised that they haven't just been shut down. I think this is an incredibly shocking event. But what about the fact that he was an Asian American and that was apparently one of the quote unquote belligerent things that he was saying when protesting this?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, Dan, and that goes to the part of what Laura was saying. If we knew, right, for an absolute fact that they had conducted a totally random lottery to determine who would get booted from the plane, I think we might feel differently about the incident. If we knew that they signaled out someone who they thought would be compliant based on racial characteristics, that's abhorrent on a completely other level. And I think this is all to be determined, and he's lawyered up and it's probably going to come out. Either way, I mean, it was just, you know, inartful. I mean, I can't even come up with the right word for it. I mean, it was handled so badly from top to bottom.
Anyway, it's hard. It's impossible to imagine this happening to a white man. It's difficult to imagine it happening to a white woman. It just seems like it's another of these moments. And I'm sorry to keep on invoking Trump again and again, but I feel like things have nakedly come to the surface, right? I mean, to bring in an unrelated incident at these protests in Berkeley last weekend, a white woman is punched in the face by a Nazi. You know, I mean, there's just these moments of kind of the public decay of morals that I feel like Kristallnacht is around the corner when this shit happens. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is why Richard Spencer never should have been bashed in the head on camera, though we don't want to open that can of worms again. Laura Miller is one of my favorite book critics, and I'm so glad you came back on the show, Laura. It was great to talk to you.
It was fun. Thanks.
Come to Facebook.com/CultureFest, listeners, and tell us what you thought of this United incident. I'm sure that we've missed some of its nuances, and tell us how it struck you. Okay, moving on. All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you got?
That was so much suspense in that N. I don't think I can live up to it with my puny little endorsement. I actually do have a small, in the sense of not demanding a huge amount of time investment from the listener, endorsement this week, maybe because I myself am sick and didn't have the capacity to read anything longer, but it is something really wonderful that I read on Medium this week, a post by a writer named Kate Imbach, who I hadn't heard of before, that's about Melania Trump's Twitter photography, which is not something I would have thought that I A, cared about, and B, would have been able to stand looking at. But what she does is essentially this writer just got very curious about Melania Trump's inner life, if such as it is, what can we know about it? Why is she not stepping up to the plate and moving to the White House? What is it like to be Melania Trump? Obviously, we have very little evidence by which to investigate this. So what she started doing was looking at Melania's Twitter feed and the photographs that she's posted to it over the, I don't know, 4 or 5 years that she's had one. I think she's a pretty occasional poster. But this woman basically does a close reading of the photography that she posts, much of which is just atmospheric, like the view from Trump Tower that she photographs at the exact same angle, no matter the season, and a very, very few photographs involving her family. There's only one that has Donald Trump in it, and very tellingly, her face is cut out of it completely. Anyway, these photographs tell a sort of mysterious, enigmatic, and ultimately very depressing story about what it is to be Melania Trump. The piece is called Fairy Tale Prisoner by Choice, The Photographic Eye of Melania Trump. It's on Medium, and we'll put a link to it on the show page.
That sounds very cool. Julia, what do you have?
I've got a good read. If you liked Gone Girl, you might also like Sharp Objects, the book that Gillian Flynn wrote before Gone Girl, which is just as compelling and gripping and strange and takes place in a twisted Missouri town, similarly. And read it. It's good.
All right. Well, this week, a couple things really quickly. It's that season again where I ought to recite Philip Larkin's poem, The Trees Are Coming Into Leaf, Like Something Almost Being Said. The recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. I won't do it, though. Seek out that poem. It's one of my favorites. I finally ate at Peck's Arcade in Troy, which I knew was going to be great. It was gracious, yummy, beautifully realized restaurant. You should absolutely check it out if you are in the Capital District region of New York State. Those guys are doing terrific work there. But finally, the thing I really want to endorse this week is grilled pizza. It's that season again. We're heading towards, chinos and rosé season. But for me, in addition to the chinos and the rosé, it's also making your homemade pizza on an outdoor grill is so effing good. You won't believe it. It's like orders of, I mean, pizza already is, I mean, it has to be considered among life's most infallibly satisfying things already. The fact that you can bump it up to a whole other level, you can like square it, cube its pleasures by doing it on a flame. It's so crispy. It gets a little smoky. It's really, and then you can like grill vegetables first and then add them as toppings. Integrate your grill into your pizza making and consuming life. Thank me now. Thank me later. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
Hang in there, man. Get better. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lickteig. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Networks. The Culture Gabfest is a proud member of the Panoply Network. You can check out an entire roster of like and different shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens and Laura Miller and Gia Tolentino and Mark Harris and various others who filled in, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Have a great week and we'll see you soon.